Last time, we visited Khazai Agricultural and Livestock Breeding Complex and explored their agricultural and cultivation units. This time, we will look at their advanced animal husbandry divisions and what led them to livestock rearing. To begin with, it all starts from the soil. Over time, the ground needs constant enrichment for high-yield harvests. After this company shifted to knowledge-based potato cultivation, it realized the best way to prepare the farmlands for the next round of planting was to employ the help of sheep. This company has around 2,400 hectares of farmland, and fertilizing this much land becomes a mammoth task. So, it decided to bring in the heavyweights of the fertilizing sector and started its cattle breeding unit. And as a result, it also launched its animal feed production facility, where they scientifically formulate feed and test ingredients for the best quality. As the cows are allowed to roam the lands periodically and are fed high-quality food, the dairy and meat they produce are also very nutritious. They have thousands of Holstein cattle at their rearing unit, and the milk produced is rigorously tested. Typically, livestock is fitted with digital tags. This is the animal's profile, which can be modified or added according to the animal's examination. They also serve as an identity card so caretakers can keep track of each animal's health and other features. This is also important information for veterinarians and the animal's products, which are further examined in advanced labs. Each animal born or brought to the facility is given a digital tag after a lab examination. This company's advanced veterinary and genetic lab complex carries out essential functions. It's worth mentioning that one of its labs is mainly dedicated to testing cows and their milk. Here, milk is tested for its microbial load. This usually involves a standard plate count, which determines the total number of bacteria in a sample. These results are then used to determine the grade of milk. It might be interesting to know that this company has received numerous awards for being the best model cattle breeder in the province and the country. These titles were granted based on meeting nearly 40 standards of the Ministry of Agriculture. Such achievements were made possible by dozens of expert staff employed at this company. Its other laboratory is dedicated to raising sheep. At this facility, sheep are genetically selected for specific characteristics. They are also genetically bred to produce twins and sometimes triplets. This company has never stopped eyeing the future. It plans to expand its facilities further while incorporating new technology and applying the latest science to increase the quality of its products. In 2019 was considered the golden period for red meat production in the country. Since then, production has grown each year, primarily because of the removal of an export ban. 3 years ago, Iran imported large amounts of meat to supply domestic needs, while domestic meat production was operating at full capacity. The ban was implemented to stabilize the market and support local production. Iran's Livestock Exporters National Assembly estimates domestic needs for red meat at around 60 million heads of light livestock annually. Last year, this number was 72 million, which is well above average. This meant 12 million light livestock were ready for culling and exports. The Ministry of Agriculture puts red meat's domestic per capita consumption at over 12 kilograms, with lamb being the most popular red meat. This year, the National Statistical Center, or SCI, reported red meat production stood at nearly 51,000 tons in the month of May alone. Based on the SCI figures, over 1.3 million livestock holding farms are spread across the country. 54% of these farm small livestock and 26% are dedicated to large livestock husbandry. The remaining 20% farms both large and small livestock. The meat industry in Iran is worth some $2 billion. But not all livestock are raised for meat. They are also reared for their milk. Based on the SCI, Iran annually produces nearly 9 million tons of raw milk. 70% of this amount is produced on industrial farms, and the rest comes from traditional dairy farms. Going off of figures from Iran's Customs Administration, on average, roughly 800,000 tons of raw milk are exported annually, valued at around $800 million. All things considered, Iran's livestock industry is booming and is an excellent place for investors who will see quick returns and profit. Now it's that time of the show for me to step aside for several minutes because my good friend and colleague has another awesome field report lined up for you. Take it away.
The basis of the steel industry is iron ore. It's courtesy of this critical raw material that steel is all around us. In the beneficiation process, the ganque minerals, or the mineral matter of no value that occurs with the metallic ore, is removed from the mineral substance and iron ore concentrate is produced. The concentrate is then shipped from mining plants as a bulk commodity by rail.
Hi again. The wagons carrying the iron ore concentrate have reached their destination. What happens at this stage is that through a gargantuan machine, they are overturned. This is called a wagon tippler. What it does is that it tips the wagons. It retains the wagons from the top and it overturns them. First, the wagons are detached from other wagons and then they're lifted over here. And look at those arms. Look at those arms, how gigantic they are. And now they're going to retain the wagon, overturn it to empty its load into a container. From that container, the iron ore concentrate is going to be mixed. First, it's going to travel through some distance and it's going to be mixed with some additives to be fed into the pelletizing process.
In this week's feature program, we visited Chodormalu Industrial Facility located in the center of Iran, Yazd province. The iron ore concentrate must be pelletized for use in iron and steel making. In summary, pelletizing is achieved by combining the iron ore with water and a specific binder, which is then rolled up in a balling drum to produce relatively uniform pellets, which can then be easily handled in downstream processes.
And here we are. The powder is the iron ore concentrate now mixed with some additive. It is now fed into large discs. In this industrial complex, everything is just enormous. This is called the pelleting disc. It's really huge. Now what happens here is through the use of centrifugal force, the powder gets compressed and it's just pushed to the edges of this disc. And after the powder completes a couple rotation and as it grows in size, then it forms the pellets. And once it is just large enough, it will exit the rotation because of that centrifugal force and it moves over to the conveyor belt and it's now time for grading. Now, those particles that are just perfect in size and shape, they will move on to travel over to the kiln where the content moisture is removed and sintering takes place. So the iron pellet now gets hardened and after that, cooling takes place. Now, stay with us for more.
Chodormalu's pelletizing plant, with a production capacity of 3.4 million tons per year, employs 500 people directly and another 3,000 indirectly. The iron ore pellets will be transferred to stackers and are piled in an area which can store 300,000 tons of pellets.
Fe2O3, I don't know how familiar you are with chemistry and the chemical reactions and the periodic table, but anyway, at this stage of the process, Fe2O3 is going to be turned into Fe through a process that is called direct reduction of iron. And this process is done by three main stages. The first stage occurs a ball furnace. The pellets are poured into the furnace. And what happens inside the furnace is two gases are going to hit the pellets. The gases are carbon monoxide and molecular hydrogen. They're extracted from natural gas through a process that is called reformation. and two gases are going to hit the pellets, and through three chemical reactions, Fe2O3 is going to turn into Fe, which is called the reduced iron, or also sponge iron because of its high porosity. Now, this process can be done in two different ways. One is called hot direct reduction of iron, and the other one is called cold direct reduction of iron. Now, I'm going to move on to the next and the final stage, steel production.
Hot direct reduced iron, or HDRI, is DRI that is transported hot directly from the reduction furnace into an electric arc furnace, thereby saving energy. Whereas cold DRI is the one that is cooled and stored before being charged to a furnace. Well, on the face of it, there's no reason for facilities to even consider cold DRI, but in reality, it's not really that simple. The development of mankind would have been impossible but for steel. It fueled the Industrial Revolution and remains the backbone of modern industrialized economies. The process continues with primary steelmaking, which is done via electric arc furnace at Chodormalu, and then moves on to secondary steelmaking, which involves treating, continuous casting, and shaping.
The final product is made, the steel billet, and you can tell how hot it is in here. Well, the process here starts with the electric arc furnace. It melts the sponge iron that I talked about earlier. And what happens next is that we need some ladles. Ladles are containers. They're going to contain the molten material. Then the ladles are taken over some molds. Molds are going to carry the molten material. And as the molten material is carried over some distance, it solidifies into the final product, which is this steel billet. Now, this complex is really huge. Everything inside it is gigantic. And I've been with you from the very beginning of this process, the iron concentrate, to the very end.
Thanks for that educational adventure once again. Well, that covers our show for today. I have been Samson Sees. Sees you in the next bazaar.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump has taken his argument that he should be immune from prosecution, which was shut down by a federal judge, to an appeals court. In court papers filed on Saturday night, 23rd of December, Trump once again tried to derail Special Prosecutor Jack Smith's case that charges him with trying to overturn the 2020 election. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The American newspaper The Hill has covered this story and tells us more. Former President Trump's lawyers asked a federal appeals court to toss his 2020 election subversion case in Washington, D.C., just one day after the Supreme Court declined special counsel Jack Smith's request to take up Trump's argument that his actions are protected from criminal prosecution under presidential immunity. In a court filing to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals on Saturday night, 23rd of December, Trump's attorneys reiterated their push for the appeals court to overturn a lower court's ruling that rejected the former president's immunity claim. Donald Trump introduced the argument back in October, saying his actions leading up to and surrounding the 6th of January 2021 attack on the Capitol are protected by presidential immunity. Federal Judge Tanya Chutkan ruled earlier this month that the United States has only one chief executive at a time, and that position does not confer a lifelong get-out-of-jail free pass. The former president is facing four felony counts alleging he was involved in a conspiracy to defraud the United States and stood at the center of a campaign to block the certification of Electoral College votes on 6th of January 2021. In the latest court filing, Trump's lawyers once again argued Trump's conduct constitutes official acts to advocate for and defend the intensity of the federal election. In accord with his view, it was tainted by fraud and irregularity. Arguing the indictment is unlawful and unconstitutional, Trump's lawyers said he must first be impeached and convicted by the Senate before he can be criminally prosecuted for his official acts as president. Before any single prosecutor can ask the court to sit in judgment on the president's conduct, Congress must have approved of it by impeaching and convicting the president. That did not happen here, and so President Trump has absolute immunity. The oral argument for the appeals case is slated for 9th of January, according to court filings. The trial is scheduled to begin on 4th of March. National broadcaster CBS News has also covered the same story. Former President Donald Trump's legal team has asked the federal appeals court to toss the criminal case, alleging he violated multiple criminal statutes in his attempt to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election, arguing that Donald Trump possesses presidential immunity. In a 71-page late-night filing with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, Donald Trump's attorneys requested a stay of any order by the court if it disagrees with him and his claims of presidential immunity so that Donald Trump can try to make his case to the Supreme Court instead. Trump's attorneys argued the actions that Donald Trump allegedly took, according to federal prosecutors, constitute quintessential presidential acts and fell within his official duties. During the 234 years from 1789 to 2023, no current or former U.S. president has ever been criminally prosecuted for official acts. That unbroken tradition died this year, and the historical fallout is tremendous. The Trump court filing reads, "The indictment of President Trump threatens to launch cycles of recrimination and politically motivated prosecution that will plague our nation for many decades to come and stands likely to shatter the very bedrock of our republic, the confidence of American citizens in an independent judicial system." In the Saturday night court filing, Donald Trump's legal team insisted his criminal case should be dismissed because he wasn't convicted by the U.S. Senate in his second impeachment trial in 2021, claiming that would violate his protections against double jeopardy. Impeachment is a political process, not a criminal one, according to the U.S. Constitution. The latest Trump court filing comes one day after the Supreme Court declined to fast-track the landmark case determining whether Trump is absolutely immune from prosecution for any crimes he allegedly committed whilst in office. The Supreme Court's decision not to immediately take up the case allows the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia to first determine whether Donald Trump can be prosecuted for his alleged efforts to alter the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. The Supreme Court is still likely to take up that question, but not imminently. The Supreme Court's decision to not weigh in for now was a blow to special counsel Jack Smith and his team of prosecutors. Trump first filed a motion to dismiss the indictment on grounds of presidential immunity on 5th of October. CNN cable news network has also covered the same story. Donald Trump urged a federal appeals court to throw out the federal election subversion criminal case in Washington, D.C., again arguing in a filing late on Saturday, 23rd of December, that he's protected under the presidential immunity. Trump wants the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals to overturn a lower court's ruling rejecting his claims of immunity in special counsel Jack Smith's election subversion case. The appeals panel is weighing Donald Trump's request, which the Supreme Court on Friday refused to take up, on an expedited basis. The court filing reiterates what the former president's lawyers have repeatedly asserted, that Donald Trump was working in his official capacity as the U.S. president to ensure election integrity when he allegedly undermined the 2020 election results and therefore has immunity, and that his indictment is unconstitutional because presidents cannot be criminally prosecuted for official acts of duty unless they're impeached and convicted by the U.S. Senate. The Constitution establishes a powerful structural check to prevent political factions from abusing the formidable threat of criminal prosecution to disable the president and attack their political enemies, Trump's attorneys wrote in the court filing. Before any single prosecutor can ask a court to sit in judgment of the president's conduct, Congress must have approved of it by impeaching and convicting the president, they wrote. That did not happen here, and so President Donald Trump has absolute immunity. The former president has been attempting to delay his 4th of March trial in the case, with his fight over the immunity claim underscoring those efforts. The appeals court has expedited its consideration of his appeal and is set to hear oral arguments in the matter on 9th of January. District Judge Tanya Chutkan, who is overseeing his criminal case, temporarily paused all procedural deadlines in the case whilst the appeal plays out. The Supreme Court on Friday rejected a request from Special Prosecutor Jack Smith for the justices to immediately hear the case before the D.C. Circuit had a chance to weigh in. Both sides will have the option of appealing the eventual ruling from the appeals court back up to the highest court in the land.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Christians and Christianity are under attack in Gaza and Palestine more generally. Zionist ideology is not just anti-Muslim, it is anti-Christian too. What is the common factor that links Muslims and Christians in Palestine? They're Palestinian. So it's no surprise that the Zionists are making sure to destroy churches as well as mosques. On October the 19th, Israel bombed the Church of St. Porphyrius, Gaza's oldest, killing at least 18 people. The church is said to be the third oldest Christian church in the world, with the current building having been constructed by the Crusaders in the 1150s or 1160s. A church was built on the site as early as 425 AD. 2 days earlier, an explosion at Al-Ahli Arab Hospital, an Anglican institution located a few blocks away, killed and injured hundreds, according to Palestinian health authorities. The evidence is beginning to mount that the attacks on specifically Christian targets are themselves a specific genocide contained within the larger genocide aimed at Muslims and indeed all Palestinians. On December 16th, the Zionists directly targeted a Christian convent. An Israeli army sniper assassinated two Christian women, Nahed and her daughter Samar, inside the parish of the Holy Family in Gaza on Saturday, said the Latin Patriarchate's media office. One of the women fell while trying to rescue the other. Seven others were injured while attempting to help. Gunfire was directed at them inside the walls of the monastery, and there was no resistance in the area, it added. An Israeli artillery vehicle also targeted the Monastery of the Sisters of Mother Teresa in Gaza City, which shelters more than 54 disabled individuals within the church walls. The Zionist attack also destroyed the fuel tank, the power generator, and the solar panels, in addition to extensive damage that rendered the place unsuitable for habitation or providing care for people with disabilities. On January the 26th this year, a mob of Israeli settlers attacked an Armenian bar in the Christian quarter of the Old City of Jerusalem, shouting, "Death to Arabs, death to Christians." At the beginning of October, a video emerged of ultra-Orthodox settlers in Al-Quds spitting on Christian pilgrims. Armed and violent settlers are also in the process of attempting to liquidate the Armenian quarter in Al-Quds, and with it, the wider Christian presence, which has been there continuously since the 4th century. Only 800 to 1,000 Christians are believed to still live in Gaza, constituting the oldest Christian community in the world, dating back to the 1st century.
This year, Christmas celebrations are cancelled in Bethlehem, and for obvious reasons. It's impossible to celebrate while our people in Gaza are going through a genocide.
It's no wonder the church in Palestine has cancelled Christmas.
Hunger has become the most pressing of the myriad problems facing hundreds of thousands of displaced Gaza Palestinians, with aid trucks able to bring in only a small fraction of what is needed, and distribution uneven due to the chaos of the war. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, a Geneva-based rights group, has found that 71% of people in the Gaza Strip suffer from extreme hunger due to Israel's devastating war on the Palestinian territory and the regime's method of using starvation as a weapon. The group released the figure after it conducted an analytical study of a sample of 1,200 people in Gaza. According to the study's findings, 98% of respondents said that they eat insufficient amounts of food, while 64% of the participants admitted to eating grass, immature food, and expired materials to satiate their hunger.
All 2.2 million people are hungry, meaning that they are in crisis or worse food security situation.
More than 130,000 of Gaza's most vulnerable children, that is newborns up to 2 years of age, are not receiving the critical life-saving breastfeeding or age-appropriate complementary feeding that they absolutely require. So that's our scenario. Without sufficient safe water, food and sanitation that only a humanitarian ceasefire would bring, child deaths due to disease could well surpass those already killed in bombardments.
The study found that the rate of access to water in the Gaza Strip, including drinking, bathing and cleaning water, is 1.5 liters per person per day. This is 15 liters less than the minimum amount of water required for survival at the level required by international standards. Additionally, the study examined the effects of malnutrition and a lack of access to clean drinking water. 66% of the study sample reported having experienced diarrhea, skin rashes, or intestinal diseases in the past month. Even in Rafah, which has a crossing to Egypt through which aid trucks enter, the dearth of food and clean water is so severe it is causing people to get ill.
The contaminated water is another issue, as the water is not 100% clean, so children and adults suffer from intestinal problems such as vomiting and diarrhea. So I ran out of antidiarrheal medications, flagyl medicines, which is an intestinal disinfectant, and Silabrin, which is antibiotics for intestinal infections. There's a significant loss of these drugs.
Since the start of its genocide in Gaza, Israel has imposed a comprehensive blockade on the Strip and prevented supplies of food, water, fuel, and other humanitarian necessities from reaching the more than 2.3 million residents of the Strip. Israel's use of starvation as a weapon has intensified since October 7 and has included cutting off all food supplies to Gazans, as well as bombing and destroying the Strip's bakeries, factories, food stores.
We were compelled to come here as there are no bakeries available. The people here who are our friends are baking bread to aid the community. Procuring flour is challenging for us, as a 20-kilogram bag costs around 300 to 400 shekels, which is a substantial amount.
About 577,000, meaning more than 500,000 people, are already in catastrophic levels of hunger, meaning they're essentially starving. That is like one in every poor people.
Speeches and statements from Israeli officials promoting a campaign to deliberately block access to necessary resources for the Gaza population as a strategy indicate that Israel has not made these intentions a secret. The Israeli blockade, on top of the genocidal aggression, has plunged Gaza into humanitarian catastrophe, where lack of access to sanitation and safe water has increased the prevalence of waterborne diseases. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court says that intentionally starving civilians by, quote, depriving them of objects indispensable to their survival, including willfully impeding relief supplies, is a war crime.
The people in the hospitals, yes, they need everything. They need medical supplies, but what they ask for first is food and water, the very basics. They do not have them. One of my colleagues described people lying on the floor in severe pain, in agony, but they weren't asking for pain relief. They were asking for water.
The plight of Gaza's 2.3 million people has become desperate amid the war. Around 80% of Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip have been displaced by the violence, while efforts to get aid into the territory have struggled. Alarmed humanitarian organizations have been calling for a ceasefire and denouncing the shocking cost of the catastrophic war, which amounts to a collective punishment of the civilian population of Gaza.
We are homeless. We can't go back to our houses. I want to see my children. I want to go back to my husband and to my house. It's unfair. It's so unfair.
This is a firm response to Israel's genocide and aggression against Palestinians. It has been about 2.5 months since Israel launched its deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Muslim countries missed no chance to deplore the Israeli crimes verbally, but there were few, including Yemen, that firmly stood in solidarity with defenseless Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. After carrying out drone and missile strikes on Israeli targets, Yemen's armed forces have now been targeting Israel-bound vessels in waters around their country. The army has time and again stated it would stop its operations if Israel stops its aggression and ends its blockade on Gaza. The Yemeni armed forces have also refuted claims about targeting ships moving toward other destinations. All vessels except Israel-bound ones can safely sail through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. As usual, Israel's main backer, the U.S., has been trying to reverse the impact of the Yemeni operations by announcing the formation of a maritime coalition under the pretext that it would protect the transit in the Red Sea. But Washington's main goal is to protect Israel's interest. However, Yemen's Ansarullah has issued strong warning to the U.S. Mohammed al-Bukhaiti, a senior Ansarullah official, says the newly formed coalition will get a painful response if it violates the sovereignty of the Arab country. But how significant the Yemeni operations in the Red Sea are? In recent weeks, Yemeni naval forces have targeted several vessels sailing through the Red Sea toward Israel. Their primary goal has been to exert economic pressure on Tel Aviv, and they have been rather successful. Several major companies have suspended their shipments to and from Israel in the wake of Yemen's operations in the Red Sea. This has dealt a heavy blow to Israel's economy, with the latest reports indicating that the port of Eilat is hardly hit as the result of this disruption.
The non-arrival of ships to Eilat means that there's no income for the port, while the fixed expenses for its maintenance and operation remain the same, and we have a substantial negative flow.
The almost complete halt to the arrival of ships to Eilat has led to an 80% fall in the port's profits. This is while reports say that Egypt's Suez Canal has seen no harm to its maritime activities during Yemen's operations against Israel-bound ships. The Red Sea is a strategic trade route connecting Asia to Europe through the Suez Canal. About 12% of global trade passes through the Red Sea, including 30% of global container traffic. The disruptions in this area have had a direct impact on global economy. Now, cargo ships traveling from Asia to Europe have to sail around the African continent. This has increased the transit time and led to higher freight rates and delays. Also, shipping insurance costs have jumped by tens of thousands of dollars a day, and oil prices have gone up as well. To sum up, the international community has been unable to stop the Israeli crimes against Palestinians through political means. However, it seems Yemenis have employed a successful tactic to pressurize Israel.
UN agencies continue to sound the alarm bell over the desperate humanitarian situation in the besieged coastal territory. The head of the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees has warned that the people of Gaza are running out of time and options. Philippe Lazzaroni warned that Gaza is very far from an adequate humanitarian response.
The people of Gaza are running out of time and options as they face bombardment, deprivation, and disease in an ever shrinking space.
He described the situation in Gaza as hell on earth and said people in the Palestinian territory are facing the darkest chapter of its history since 1948. He described seeing people halting in aid truck and in desperation and swallowing down the food found inside where they stood in the street. Further noted that the people of Gaza are now crammed into less than one-third of their original territory near the Egyptian border, and the dire situation might spark an exodus. The city of Rafah on the Egyptian border, the only crossing where aid is entering Gaza, has seen its population explode from 280,000 to more than a million.
Rafah is the epicenter of the displacement of the Gazan. There is over 1 million people who have fled in this governorate, most of them, as we know, have been moved more than once since the beginning of the war. Rafah has quadrupled its number of people overnight, and especially when the offensive in the south has started.
UN officials have warned that any such exodus would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and it would make a problematic Palestinian problem more difficult. It is now widely believed that the Israeli regime is deliberately targeting residential areas and the critical infrastructure in Gaza in order to make the territory unlivable for its residents. Israel has already pushed the U.S. and its other Western allies to persuade Egypt to accept Palestinian people in the Sinai Peninsula.
It seems very difficult to us that if there was a population movement outside Gaza, I think that can only mean Egypt. It would be extremely destabilizing for Egypt, for the Sinai region, and that would make a solution to the Palestinian problem even more difficult.
The healthcare system is collapsing. Expect public order to completely break down soon. And an even worse situation could unfold, including epidemic diseases and increased pressure for mass displacement into Egypt. I said that we are facing a severe risk of collapse of the humanitarian system.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you.
Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
At least 70 people were killed in Gaza's Maghazi refugee camp on Sunday, December 24th, in one of the deadliest strikes of war, as death toll across the Gaza Strip spirals amid intensive Zionist regime's bombardment. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote in this regard, Gaza's deadliest ever war cast a pall of gloom over Beit Lahm on Christmas Eve on Sunday, December 24th, as the death toll spiraled and the Zionist regime shifted its efforts against Hamas to the besieged territories south. Gaza Health Ministry said an Israeli regime strike late on Sunday, December 24th, killed at least 70 people in the Maghazi refugee camp in central Gaza and destroyed several houses. If the death toll is confirmed, it will be one of the deadliest strikes since the war began on October 7th. Health Ministry spokesperson Ashraf Al-Qudra said the toll is likely to rise as many families were thought to be in the area at the time of the strike. Qudra said, "What is happening at the Maghazi camp is a massacre that is being committed on a crowded residential square." Hamas issued a statement calling the airstrike a horrific massacre and said it was a new war crime. More than 20,400 people have now been confirmed killed, according to authorities in Gaza, and thousands more are believed dead under the rubble. The vast majority of the 2.3 million Gazans have been driven from their homes, and the United Nations says conditions are catastrophic. Christmas celebrations were effectively cancelled in the occupied West Bank city of Beit Lahm, revered as the birthplace of Jesus Christ, where the Latin Patriarch offered a message of solidarity with the Palestinians of Gaza. And Pope Francis kicked off Mass at St. Peter's Basilica in Rome with a call for peace. The Catholic leader said, "Tonight our hearts are in Bethlehem, where the Prince of Peace is once more rejected by the futile logic of war, by the clash of arms that even today prevents him from finding room in the world." U.S. President Joe Biden earlier stressed the critical need to protect civilians in a call with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who vowed the Zionist regime would continue the war until all of its goals have been achieved, according to official statements. As heavy fighting raged on, the Zionist regime's army said 154 troops had died in Gaza since it launched a ground invasion on October 27th. 10 Israeli regime troops were killed in battle, one of the deadliest, says, for the Israeli side. Netanyahu said the war is exacting a very heavy price, but we have no choice but to keep fighting. The Zionist regime's withering military campaign, including massive aerial bombardment, has killed 20,424 people, mostly women and children, according to Gaza's health ministry. The Gaza Health Ministry reported recently a strike that killed 10 members of one family in the Jabalia camp in northern Gaza. As the Zionist regime's bombardments continue, Christians around the world marked Christmas Eve. Festivities are usually held in Beit Lahm, where faithful believe Jesus was born, but this year the city is almost deserted, with few worshippers around and no Christmas tree erected. After church leaders decided to forego any unnecessarily festive celebrations in solidarity with Gazans. The Latin Patriarch of Al-Quds arrived recently at the Church of Nativity, clad in the traditional black and white keffiyeh. He said, "Our heart goes to Gaza, to all people in Gaza, but a special attention to our Christian community in Gaza who are suffering. We are here to pray and to ask not only for a ceasefire. A ceasefire is not enough. Violence generates only violence." Sister Nabila Saleh from the Catholic Holy Church in Gaza, where two Christian women were killed by an Israeli sniper earlier this month, according to the Latin Patriarch of Al-Quds, struck a somber tone. She told AFP, "All Christmas celebrations have been cancelled. How do we celebrate when we are hearing the sound of tanks and bombardment instead of the ringing of bells?" At a hospital in Khan Yunis, where much of the fighting has been concentrated recently, Fadi Sayek, whose family has previously received permits to travel to Beit Lahm for celebration, said he would not be celebrating Christmas this year because of Gaza. He said, "There is no joy, no Christmas tree, no decorations, no family dinner, no celebrations." While undergoing dialysis, he said, "I pray for this war to be over soon." Vast areas of Gaza lie in ruins, and its 2.4 million people have endured dire shortages of water, food, fuel, and medicine due to an Israeli regime siege, alleviated only by the limited arrival of aid trucks. The Jordanian army said its air force had airdropped aid to about 800 people sheltering at the Church of Saint Porphyrius in northern Gaza. 80% of Gazans have been displaced, according to the UN, with many fleeing south and now shielding themselves against the winter cold in makeshift tents. Two Palestinian men who had been abducted by the Zionist regime army in Gaza and a medic that detainees have been subjected to torture in the Zionist regime's custody, including beatings and food deprivation. Naif Ali, 22, said he was abducted in Gaza City's eastern Zeitoun suburb and later taken to an Israeli detention facility and showed cuts on his wrists and other parts of his body. He said, "The Israeli troops tied our hands behind our backs for 2 days. We were not allowed to eat or drink. Neither were we allowed to use the toilet. There were only beatings and beatings." The head of the UN Refugee Agency, Filippo Grandi, urged an end to the suffering in the third month of the war. He said, "A humanitarian ceasefire in Gaza is the only way forward. War defies logic and humanity and prepares a future of more hatred and less peace." And World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom similarly renewed calls for a ceasefire, saying the decimation of the Gaza health system is a tragedy. Meanwhile, reports say thousands took to the streets of Rabat on Sunday, December 24th, to demand an end to Morocco's ties with the Zionist regime. Protesters waved Palestinian flags and held placards reading, "Resistance till victory. Stop Moroccan government normalization with Israel and free Palestine." Rabat normalized ties with the fabricated regime of Israel in 2020, in a deal brokered by former U.S. President Donald Trump's administration. The two regimes are yet to complete the process of setting up full embassies in each other's countries, but Morocco and the fabricated regime of Israel have moved closer together, including by signing a war cooperation pact.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with veterans from the Sacred Defense and the Resistance field. The meeting was held in the Imam Khomeini Husseiniya on September 20, 2023, inaugurating Sacred Defense Week. Another angle is who was the defense confronting? Who was it that had attacked us that necessitated a defense? This is another angle which I think is important. The third perspective or angle is who were the defenders? This is also a novel and important thing that I will mention two or three sentences about. The fourth angle is what were the results and achievements of this defense. Now, I have mentioned these four aspects, but of course, it can be viewed from other angles as well. So we need to discuss this. We need to think, study, and ask ourselves what was being defended. Second, who was the defense confronting? Third, who was doing the defending? Fourth, what was the result of this defense? I believe that each one of these issues is very important. We need to think and study each one of these issues. This is very important.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
As to what was being defended, the Islamic Revolution, the Islamic Republic, which was the product of defending the Islamic Revolution and the country's territorial integrity were being defended. These were the three important things that were being defended. The other side had attacked these three things. Of course, the target of the main important part of the front of the enemy, which I will explain later in the second part of my speech, was not the issue of territorial integrity. That was Saddam's goal. Their target was the revolution. They wanted to suppress this unparalleled, great, important revolution that had taken place in Iran thanks to the sacrifices that had been made by the people. Why do we say it was unparalleled? Because it was a phenomenon that had not taken place before in major revolutions. It was democratic, it was religious, it was authentic, and it was not dependent. It was related to a nation. It was by the people. It was not like coup, revolutions by political parties, or things of that sort.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you.
that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى و دین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt. Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
With Christmas celebrations in Al-Quds and Bethlehem cancelled, the Christian Palestinians residing in Lebanon also have no reason to be joyous. Mass Christmas services have transformed into prayers of mourning. Nahida and Samar Antoun were killed by Israeli sniper fire in Gaza. They were killed as they took refuge in a monastery.
They were killed by Israeli sniper fire, and what we heard from the Pope is not true. It was not by mistake. No one is killed in Gaza by mistake. This is a Zionist policy, and they purposely kill everyone, especially the children and every Arab, no matter what their religion. Because we are a thorn in their throat, but we will remain and they will leave.
They started shelling the churches just like they shelled the mosques.
We were first confident that when they go to the church, they will be safe.